Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. We're so glad to have you with us here this evening on Ask Herbal Health Expert Susan Weed, a two-hour radio show each Tuesday night. Herbal medicine is people's medicine, simple, safe, effective. Please bring your curiosity and health questions. Susan will enlighten, surprise, and delight you. I know most of you know Susan Weed already. She's my mom, so I know her. But for those of you who have not yet met Susan, I'd like to share she is the author of the Wise Woman Herbal series, including five wonderful books on women's health and herbal medicine, including Wise Woman Herbal for the Childbearing Year, Breast Cancer, Breast Health! The Wise Woman Way, Healing Wise, The Wise Woman Herbal, New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way, and Susan's latest book, Down There, Sexual and Reproductive Health, The Wise Woman Way. In addition to being the editor at Ash Tree Publishing and writing her books, Susan is the director of the Wise Woman Center in Woodstock, New York. The Wise Woman Center is open to the public on appointment-only basis. She offers weekend workshops, intensives, and apprenticeships throughout the season. Susan is also available to you online via wisewomanmentor.com. There you can go and view her weekly e-zine. You can subscribe to receive a notification via email each week, or you could join her mentorship program. Susan also offers distance learning correspondence courses and online courses at the Wise Woman University. But you can also just go to her website, susanweed.com, where you will find thousands of pages online with recipes, articles, art features, and so much more. Well, for now, let's see what Susan has to share with us this evening. Thank you, and welcome, Susan.
Thank you, Justine. Green blessings, everybody. I'm so glad that you could take time out of your busy days to chat with us a little bit. We've been working really hard getting ready for winter. Brr! The leaves are red and falling down, and that means you got to get ready for winter. Get all that outside water off. Get all those tender plants in and start thinking about digging roots and garlic. We've been thinking about garlic for a while now, and I've been writing about garlic for my mentored students. You've been eating any garlic, Rebecca?
I have been, yes. I actually just planted some garlic in my winter garden.
Oh, it's the perfect time for planting it, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it's here in our climate. It takes a whole year, basically, from planting the garlic until getting the garlic. And we plant like this really late in the fall as the weather is getting cold. And believe it or not, those garlic cloves somehow manage to get through the wintertime. My brother says so long as they get some roots out, they'll be fine.
Yes. I also put some clover seed here because we can overwinter our clover here and use it as a cover crop, but I planted them both together, and they're both starting to come up a little bit right now.
Oh, that's beautiful. What kind of clover?
Red clover.
Red clover, yes. Our favorite.
Yes, it is really pretty right now. It's so bright green.
Mm, it's still blooming a little bit here.
Oh, yeah.
Not, you know, fields of it, but a little bit here, a little bit there. Justine said that we had lots of people who emailed in questions.
Yeah, there are quite a few.
Maybe we should just go ahead and get started.
Okay.
All right.
Here we go. Dear Susan, after meeting you in August during the Green Goddess Intensive, I have made many changes in my life. I am 38 and have a 2-year-old son. I have been a vegetarian for 15 years and am now reintroducing meat back into my diet, starting with fish, chicken liver, and chicken soup. I am drinking the nourishing herbal infusions regularly and cook my greens for over an hour. They are delicious that way. I also eliminated all essential oils from my massage practice. It feels good to make all these changes, but at the same time, I feel as if I am falling apart. In the last 2 months, I have been the only one in my family getting sick almost every other week. I have been catching all kinds of colds and flu and even a roseola virus, losing weight, and I am already very slim and generally feeling weak. I don't know if it is a pure coincidence that this is happening with the introduction of meat into my diet or some kind of readjustment period that my body is going through or that I was going this way anyway and I just happened to meet you at a critical moment. Do you have any suggestions for me on what is going on and how I can strengthen my immune system and gain weight? Thank you so much, in love and gratitude.
It seems a little bit counterintuitive, but the fact of the matter is when we're getting sick, it means our immune system is strong. Think about it. Children get sick a lot because they have very active, very strong immune systems, whereas older people tend to get sick less and less. As a matter of fact, the people who drop dead of heart attacks who are diagnosed with metastatic cancer and dead in 6 weeks are often people about whom it's been said, gee, they were never sick a day in their lives. The heroic tradition tends to believe that not ever being sick means that you're healthy, but the wise woman tradition knows better. The wise woman tradition knows that life is about dynamic disequilibrium and that getting sick is one of the healthiest things that we can possibly do. I think you remember when you were here that I told you I was reading a very interesting history book called The Fasting Girl. And it takes place in the mid to late 1800s and talks about, through the lens of this one particular real-life woman, women's lives in that 50-year period and in industrialization and what was actually happening. And that it was actually, in a way, the beginning of the medical understanding, kind of looking at an understanding anorexia. At any rate, this woman that the book is written about claimed not to have eaten at all. At first she hadn't eaten for a year, and then that as time went on she hadn't eaten for 3 years, and time went on and time went on. And of course there was great furor about this. And she wasn't the only one. She was a rather startling case, and a lot of publicity was made about her. But she certainly wasn't the only so-called fasting girl in the United States. And ultimately, a man who was very much into fasting, and fasting as a health procedure, decided to fast in support of her because people were saying she couldn't possibly have gone that long without food. And so he decided to do a public 40-day fast. And he did, indeed, you know, right out in public where people could see, and he was guarded 24 hours a day, that he was not eating anything at all. And, of course, the consequences of his not eating soon became apparent, and as time went on, became more and more apparent. As a matter of fact, by the time he had been fasting for, I think it was 27 days, he began to throw up pieces of his own intestines, and they really didn't think he was going to make it. But he did somehow make it through to his 40 days. And when at last, bing, the timer went off and his 40 days were complete, he went right out and got a 2-pound steak and ate it. And 2 hours later, ate another steak and continued to eat pounds and pounds and pounds of steak to put the weight back on him and to strengthen himself after his fast. So I think that you can tell by my telling the story that I don't think that you're adding meat back to your diet has had any physical consequences other than to help one gain weight and to help one be stronger. I'm not sure what to say about the fact that you're losing weight. I'm wondering if you're eating enough fat. I know when I was in Alaska, if I would act like I was cold, I didn't even have to say I was cold, if I would just act like I was cold, someone would immediately turn to me and say, eat more fat, eat more meat. It could be, yes, that, you know, we happened to meet right at the point at which things were about to fall apart for you. And hooray that you have made these changes. I really support all of the changes that you've made. And I ask you to go within and to ask the wise healer within, what is it that you need and what is it that you can do? Thanks so much for reaching out, and certainly know that you can reach out as many times as you want to. Green blessings for tonight.
All right, next question. I am a 47-year-old female born with cerebral palsy. I also suffer from acid reflux, high blood pressure, and a hiatal hernia. I use honey and cinnamon for them. My question is, now that I suffer from a neurogenic bladder, contractions, hematuria, bladder spasms, and a UTI, can I take yarrow? Can yarrow cure my bladder problem? I'm so tired of pain.
I think yarrow would be a wonderful choice for you. I'd also encourage you to think about two wonderful anti-inflammatory herbs. You haven't mentioned whether or not you're drinking nourishing herbal infusions. And, of course, that's something that I like to see everyone doing, and especially people who have real health challenges as you do. There's lots of information about making nourishing herbal infusions, but I'll go over it quickly for you. 1 ounce of an herb, and that could be comfrey leaf, a fabulous anti-inflammatory. It helps to heal the skin, the bones, the ligaments, the tendons, the digestive system, the respiratory system, and the reproductive system, making all of those tissues pain-free, more flexible, and stronger at the same time. There are also special proteins in comfrey that are ever so wonderful for short-term memory formation. So I always say, remember comfrey. So we take 1 ounce of dried comfrey leaf, put it in a quart jar, fill the jar right to the top with boiling water, put a tight lid on it, and let it steep for 4 hours or overnight, whichever works better for you. Now, I find the taste of comfrey too astringent for me, and so I add the tiniest bit of mint to it. As a matter of fact, I have a very special mint that I add, which is red bergamot, also known as Oswego tea or bee balm, and I add one stalk of that. I hesitate sometimes to talk about it because I know you can't just go out and buy that. So any mint that you like could be added, just a pinch, a tiny amount, just so the comfrey doesn't taste quite so astringent. Strain that infusion and then put it in the refrigerator and drink it. For you, I would think drinking it hot with the honey that you were talking about would be an excellent, excellent thing to do. And your primary question is, can you use yarrow to help with your bladder infection? And my answer is yes, yarrow would be a wonderful ally. And also consider drinking nourishing herbal infusions of comfrey leaf and linden. Linden blossoms, one of the world's great anti-inflammatories, removes inflammation from the inside out. No more inflammation, no more pain. With linden, because it's big and fluffy, we only use 1/2 ounce of dried linden. And I much prefer the whole linden because the cut-up stuff that some people sell makes a really slimy brew. If you do wind up with that slimy brew, know that heating it up and adding a little honey will unslime it, and you should be able to drink it pretty easily. I hope this helps. Green blessings.
Next question. I'm interested in herbal remedies to treat hair loss and reduce scalp inflammation. I wasn't sure which of the book's resources might contain this information. Thank you very much for your help.
Actually, I cover hair loss and healthy scalp in 2 of my books. I cover it in New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way. in which there's an entire chapter called Hairy Problems, Too Much, Too Little. And I also cover it in Breast Cancer Question Mark, Breast Health, Exclamation Point, The Wise Woman Way, because, of course, hair loss can be a side effect of chemotherapy. But I'll let the cat out of the bag. You don't have to buy those books. You can. You can go to thewisewomanbookshop.com and get even a signed copy of the book at no extra charge of either one of those books. The best herb, I think, for wonderful hair is stinging nettle. I'd like to drink stinging nettle infusion, weighing out 1 ounce of dried stinging nettle, putting it into a quart jar, filling that right up to the top of the boiling water, putting a tight lid on it, letting it steep overnight. I strain it out the next morning. If you don't have time to let it steep overnight, 4 hours will do. I strain it out the next morning, put it in a container, put it in the refrigerator, and drink that hot or cold. Well, actually, I never drink nettle hot. I don't think nettle tastes good hot at all. It was a cold weekend last weekend, but I served nettle, and I served it cold, and I said to them, if you really, really, really want it hot, I'll go in and heat some up for you, but I just think that hot nettle is weird, and putting honey in it is not going to help at all. If you must have your nettle hot, put some miso in it. That will make it seem much more palatable. Stinging nettle revives the hair. It brings tremendous strength and resiliency to the hair. In some cultures, they also pour the nettle right over your head. And I often say, if any of your infusion goes bad, you can just dump it over your head and rub it into your scalp and your hair. Another thing that people rub into their scalp and their hair that you can make right now is burdock seed oil. I like to engage the help of several of the under seven set for harvesting my burdock burrs. And we go with paper bags and put our burdock burrs in the paper bags. And then we put them in another bag or two and jump up and down upon them. The under seven set is very good at the jumping up and down on the bags part. And then must take it all inside, because in among the burdock burrs are little bitty hairs, which are like fiberglass, and if you open that bag outside, they're going to blow around, and they get in everybody's skin, and itchy, 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 ooh, 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 no, we don't want that. We're going to keep that bag tightly closed. We're going to go inside, and then we're going to open up our bag. We'll see pieces of the burrs. We'll see those small hairs, and we'll see the burdock seed. Mm-hmm, that's what we have to do. Get the burdock seed out from those pieces of the burr and the hairs. Because we're inside, where it's still, and the wind is not going to blow those hairs toward us, we can generally gently pour the burdock seed out, and it being heavier, it will come out before the hairs do. But you'll have to kind of toss it about and turn it about and see how it works for you. And then we fill the jar about half full of the burdock seeds, and then about three-quarters full of pure olive oil, not extra virgin. You don't want to smell like a pizza when you put this on your head. Get the pure, which has no scent, and label it on top because oil seeps and ruins labels on the side. Let it sit for about 6 weeks, and then you can start rubbing it into your hair and your scalp. And I talk a lot more about burdock and burdock seed oil in my green book, Healing Wise. And green blessings to you and your hair.
Okay, next question. Thank you so much for taking the time to address our issues. Your contribution is so much appreciated. My name is Magnus, and I live in Norway. I am 36 years old, and I have been through chemotherapy for testicular cancer. It was finished in February 2012. There was a mastitis in one of my lymph nodes behind my stomach, and they removed it with surgery. Before accepting this treatment, I tried...
Okay. Rebecca, can you hear me?
Yes.
Metastasis.
Oh, metastasis.
Right, mastitis is an infection of the breast.
Right. Sorry about that.
That's okay. Metastasis. It took... I couldn't hear what you were saying because I'm trying to figure out how a lymph node can have mastitis.
Right.
Right.
My mistake.
So when I finally figured it out, I stopped you, and maybe somebody else was confused too. So let's try that sentence from the top with the word mastitis. Not mastitis. Metastatic.
Metastatic.
Or metastasis. Right? Metastatic cancer or metastasis.
Metastasis.
That's what it says, right?
Yes, metastasis.
There okay. We go. Okay. Thank you.
There was a metastasis in one of my lymph nodes behind my stomach, and they removed it with surgery. Before accepting this treatment, I tried to do the best of my ability to reverse the cancer, mostly with a raw food diet. This didn't work for me, and I had to work through my resistance towards allopathic medicine, which is a good thing. Anyway, I'm now suffering from some side effects. I feel my immune system is compromised. I've had tinnitus from before, but it is way worse.
I'm sorry.
My doctor says my ear looks
perfectly
healthy.
Sorry, Rebecca, I just don't understand. She's had tentative? I don't know what that means.
It's T-I-N-I-T-U-S.
Tinnitus.
Okay, tinnitus.
Tinnitus. Okay, thank you.
Okay. From before, but it was way worse. My doctor says my ear looks perfectly healthy. I have a very low tolerance for stress. My short-term memory is weakened. Energy is fluctuating between high and low, and I also have this fear of a relapse since I have the belief that allopathic medicine doesn't cure but only suppresses symptoms, and that makes me worried about what and when the next issue will happen to me. I've just started drinking nourishing herbal infusions. I'm working myself through my addiction to food, which I have been with since I was around 8 years old. I've also had other challenges with addictions later in life. I'm trying to find a good diet for me, but find that I always end up with a fanatical diet deprived of something that I like, and that I always end up craving something. This makes me end up eating bad foods again. I know I need to get stable in my diet because that is most likely the underlying cause of the cancer in the first place. And that is the whole question.
Okay, wow. I'd like to talk at first in general. There are two ways to practice medicine, and they are called allopathy and homeopathy. Treating cancer with raw food is just as allopathic as treating it with chemotherapy. Allo means opposite. Homeo means the same. Pathy means disease. So allopathic practitioners such as myself, every herbalist is an allopath, such as chiropractors, acupuncturists, massage therapist, all allopathic medicine. Do something different. If somebody has a sore throat, we give them something soothing. Whereas a homeopath treats like with like. If someone has a sore throat, they give them a very dilute form of an herb that causes sore throats. If someone has an itch, they give them a very dilute form of poison ivy. So since you have not engaged in any homeopathic medicine that you've mentioned, please be aware that all of the medicine that you have engaged in is allopathic medicine. And if you wish to carry on these beliefs about allopathic medicine, then I think it wisest to understand that a raw food diet is the worst possible choice for anyone dancing with cancer. Let's be clear. Nothing on this planet eats raw food. There is no nutrition of any kind available from raw food. Now, you may be quite startled by these assertions. You may think I am totally bonkers. I don't have time right now on our Blog Talk show to go into all of the details about how it is that you think that things eat raw food, but they are not, in fact, eating raw food. But I would refer you to my raw versus cooked debate, which you can find at YouTube. And that's an hour-long show, which will help you understand how it is that you have set yourself up for absolute disaster by eating raw food. I'm also tremendously concerned by your saying that you're working through your addiction to food. Excuse me? Is that like saying you're working through your addiction to breathing? Is that like saying you're working through your addiction to being alive? No. You certainly have, as you say, a distorted relationship with nourishment. I'm happy to see if we can bring your relationship with nourishment back into a healthy realm so that you know that you deserve to be in a body and you deserve to eat and you deserve to have pleasure from your body and from your food. So, what can I say? The only diet that has ever been shown to reverse cancer is a macrobiotic diet in which no raw food of any kind is allowed. Oh, my goodness. So if you do want a specialized diet for your cancer, then I would say macrobiotic diet would be a very good idea. Many people find that when they're in your situation, that they prefer to eat only organic food and to eat only food that they have control over, which means little or no eating out, but eating at home and really enjoying the food that you have. I think it's quite important that you start eating well-cooked leafy greens, kale or collards, great choice. Make sure you get them organic, chop them up, and then cook them for a minimum of 1 hour. For you, I would really like to see you eating kale or collards that have been cooked for 2, 3, or even 4 hours. I certainly want to see a good quantity of oil laid down on those greens when you cook them. And, of course, you know it's coming. I think you should be drinking nourishing herbal infusions as well. Whether or not you wind up dancing into health with this cancer or dancing into death with this cancer, drinking nourishing herbal infusions will improve the way you feel every day you do it. There's lots of information out on making and drinking nourishing herbal infusions in my books at the Wise Woman University and at the YouTubes as well. So check out the raw versus cooked. In fact, I'll tell you what my heart is really saying here, and that is I would very much love it if you would choose to be a mentored student so that we could have a personal relationship, because this isn't something that's just going to reverse itself overnight. I'd like the opportunity to work with you over time. Green blessings.
Next question. I have been told to give my 11-year-old daughter iodine to help protect her against radiation that will soon be in this country coming from Japan. Any advice on what to do?
Well, you know, I have a very good friend, and her job is to monitor, measure, and if necessary, remediate the discharge of radioactivity and noxious chemicals from power plants and industries. And I said to her, how concerned are you about the radioactivity that's coming from Japan? And she said, I am not in the least bit concerned. I said, are you going to give your 4-year-old daughter anything? And she said, no, I'm not. On the other hand, she says, you know that we eat a very healthy diet, which includes well-cooked leafy greens. We drink nourishing herbal infusions, and I include seaweed as part of our diet. Because I'm eating a lot of seaweed, I feel that I'm getting adequate amounts of iodine. In fact, she says, you know, all nuclear facilities release radioactive iodine. They have a amount that they can release on a daily basis, and some do release it on a daily basis, but others save up and release it all at once so they can, like, save up for 365 days and then release all that amount at once. She said, and when a plant does that, it's far more than we would be getting from what's going on in Japan. So she says it's a little late to start worrying. I'm not sure where you're living. I certainly may be in the dark about it, but I haven't heard any government advisory saying that we should all be taking iodine. And believe me, if there was a problem, there would be a government advisory. There certainly was in the Scandinavian countries when the accident at Chernobyl occurred. I hope this reassures you. If you're thinking about seaweed, may I suggest that you think about kelp, wakame, kombu, or nereocystis kelp. The other seaweeds, although they're quite wonderful, I certainly like sea palm fronds and dulse and nori, they just don't have the kind of oomph that the kelp does for really helping us through difficult times. Wakame and kombu are available from Maine Sea Vegetable, M-A-I-N-E, Maine, the state, Sea Vegetable. Nereocystis kelp is available through Ryan Drum. He lives on Waldron Island in Washington, and that's all the address you need. There's only 70-some-odd people on the island. Green blessings.
So we have a caller here. I'm going to open up the line.
Oh, but just a second. I wanted to ask you, Rebecca, have you heard any advisory or any large-scale thing about people should take iodine tablets?
I haven't heard anything about the iodine tablets, but I know that people are concerned about radiation. That's a common concern. I've heard of people talking about radiation in seaweed, or I mean in like fish and stuff, and other things coming from the sea. Yeah.
Yeah. So I hope you two feel reassured by what my friend has to say, that the levels are not really any higher than they already are given nuclear power plants. Now, certainly for a very, very long time, since the 70s, I have been extremely active at making sure that new nuclear power plants are not built and that old ones are closed in the United States. I truly think that that is the best way to go. What we're going to do instead, that's certainly a difficult question. Okay, let's have our caller.
All right. In the 802 area code, you have a question for Susan?
Yes, I do, and thank you. And this has just been very enlightening as usual. Thank you. Thank you so much. My question is this. In February, I will be 59 years old, and I have been dealing with constipation since my early 40s. And I just, you know, it doesn't matter what I do. It just doesn't go away. It's gotten worse over the years. And I have, you know, I mean, I think that I look like I'm 5 or 6 months pregnant because I have continual bloating. I mean, it's just, I mean, I wear, you know, yoga pants and sweatpants. I couldn't possibly wear anything that zippered up because, you know, I'm just so incredibly bloated and gassy and extremely uncomfortable all the time.
I hear you. When you say you're constipated, could you be a little more specific for me?
Yeah, I mean, I literally stopped going to the bathroom. And then when I would, you know, I mean, it just, I mean, when I would, it would come out, you know, just a couple of, you know, like, goat turds, very hard and rocky, but this would be after days.
Thank you. And when you say nothing has worked, could you be more specific about the things that haven't worked?
Well, I mean, I've tried different herbal formulas, which, you know, do work, but, you know, I don't want to be dependent on them. I've taken large doses of, like, probiotics. I do, from time to time, do colonics, and I do enemas on a regular basis.
Well, look no further for your problem. Let's do just a little simple basic anatomy here. There are two different kinds of muscle in the human body. The skeletal muscle, which is the muscle that we're used to, is paired muscle. So if I extend my arm, one side of my arm, the muscle stretches and the other side it contracts. And then if I bend my arm, the opposite happens. The one that was contracting now extends. The one that was extending now contracts. And that's how I move. However, other parts of the body, including the intestines, don't work with paired muscle. The muscular, and I'm using muscle in a rather loose term here, contractions of the intestine are called peristalsis. And peristalsis is the movement from the mouth to the anus And it is a rather rippling wave-like movement that goes through the intestines. I wouldn't want you to think that there's kind of like one wave that goes from the mouth right through to the end, because like any ocean, there's kind of waves, and they splash in and they splash back. They're going forward. They are going toward the end, shall we say. But there's this regular rhythm that's moving through the intestines. Enemas destroy that rhythm. It takes, depending on the person, 2 to 5 days for peristalsis to resume after an enema. Colonics not only destroy the rhythm, they strip the colon of the bacteria that help you have a bowel movement. In fact, the bowel movement is mostly dead bacteria. So when we do enemas and colonics, then we can't actually have a bowel movement because we have killed and removed the bacteria that allow us to have a bowel movement.
Well, before I even started any of those things, you know, I went months and months with, you know, discomfort. And before that, I never had any, you know, I never had to deal with constipation at all. And it was at the time I had gotten sick, and I was diagnosed both with Hashimoto's autoimmune thyroiditis and systemic yeast, mold, and fungus issues.
And who diagnosed you?
Well, medical doctors. I was with
regular medical doctors.
Right, regular, yeah, not alternative.
I've never heard a regular medical doctor say that anyone had a yeast overgrowth.
Well, he did. He was an allergist immunologist, and you know, he tested me with many, many blood tests, and.
Certainly, I've heard of people having mold problems and so on and so forth.
Heard of what?
Certainly, I've heard of people having allergic reactions to mold and so on.
Well, yeah, I was in contaminated housing. So,
if you are living in housing that has a lot of mold, that certainly can be a problem. But what I'm saying is, in order for us to have a bowel movement, there has to be certain things in place. One, there has to be a great many bacteria in the colon. If you would stop doing enemas and colonics, you would begin the movement back to health. Two, there must be adequate fiber in the diet. That fiber can come from cooked things like whole grains, or it can come from uncooked things like salads.
I eat
but
a
there
ton
must...
of, yeah, I mean, I eat... You,
I'm sorry?
I do eat a lot of fiber in the, you know, I mean, every meal I've got vegetables and, you know, I eat a lot of vegetables and fruit and...
And how well cooked are your vegetables?
I either steam them or saute them.
Not good enough.
Okay. Well,
Most vegetables need to be cooked for about an hour.
Okay. And what's the best way to do that? I do sometimes.
Steaming is okay if you'll do it for long enough. Sauteing is okay if you'll do it for long enough.
Okay.
So, for instance, we might take a saute pan, throw some green beans into hot fat in the saute pan and saute them for 5 minutes or until they're brown. And then we put some water, maybe a handful of water and some tamari in the pan, turn the fire down on low, put a tight lid on it, and let it cook like that for 45 to 55 minutes.
Yeah, I do exactly what you say, but I don't cook it long enough.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because when those beans are not cooked adequately, they contain what scientists call anti-nutritional substances that interfere with our ability to get nutrition and interfere with our ability to have bowel movement. What happens when you drink prune juice?
Well, I'd have to really drink a ton because I have experimented with that. I'm willing to do anything that you suggest. But there was a time where I was drinking, you know, a lot of prune juice, and I was, I think that three times a day I was doing prunes. I would cook prunes or soak prunes. And I was like, in order to get have a bowel movement, I had to have at least 8 prunes 3 times a day. And that was the only thing that would bring, you know, if I tried to do 6 or less than that, I would not have a bowel movement.
But so prunes does work, but it requires you
it
to
does.
Eat a fair quantity. Now, let me also do a little historical searching here. Have you ever had surgery in the pelvic area?
No.
So no cesarean section?
No.
No tummy tuck?
No, nothing. Nothing like that. No, I've just had one baby and that's it, and one pregnancy.
Okay, so your tubes weren't tied. There's no appendicitis?
No.
No appendicitis that was treated?
No.
No kidney stones? Okay. Because it's certainly possible, if there's been surgery in the abdominal area, for strictures to develop around the intestine, which then make having a bowel movement difficult, and the difficulty increases as those strictures get tighter. And in that case, doing an enema can actually result in death.
Yeah.
So the herb that I most favor for helping to restore regularity is yellow dock.
Yellow dock, okay.
Dock, that's R-U-M-E-X, Rumex. There are several kinds of Rumex. The books usually cite Rumex crispus, and that's a wonderful one.
Can you spell that again?
R-U-M, like rum, E-X, like a has-been.
Oh,
Rumex.
Okay.
R-U-M-E-X.
Got it.
It's called yellow dock, and it's the root, and you would want to get a tincture of it. Now, could you tell me where you live?
Yeah, I live in Burlington, Vermont.
Oh, there's a yellow dock growing right outside your door.
Well, good.
And you can go and you can dig the root, and you can chop it up and put it in a jar and pour 100-proof vodka over it and make your own tincture.
Okay.
It's that easy. There's probably a YouTube of me doing it. And I'm sure that the people around you know what yellow dock is. Let me give you one other clue to it. It has a rather tall seed stalk. It's usually at least knee-high and can sometimes get quite a bit higher than that. And the seed stalk is a kind of pretty rusty brown, and the seeds are clustered all along the upper half of the seed stalk. Many people bring these seed stalks in for winter decorations because, unlike cattails, they hold their seeds all winter and don't make a mess in your house.
Well, if I'm confused, I can call Guido Massey because he comes up and does classes, and he's done a lot of foraging around Burlington. So
there you go. Yellow dock is a common weed throughout the entire northeastern part of the United States.
Right.
I'm sure you'll be able to find some, and this is just the right time to dig up that root and make a tincture of it. And then the dosage of the tincture. Most people start with 5 to 10 drops, and if you that you need more, you could start with more. It cannot create dependency. It works with the natural peristalsis, and so it is safe to take yellow dock every single day.
Okay. Now, it's Any other dietary ideas or suggestions?
You know better than I. It sounds like you have a few allergies, so you'll know best what works for you. The broadest diets, the diets that include the most different things, are the healthiest diets. As soon as we start limiting our diets, we start limiting our health. If you need to limit your diet for a particular reason, that's fine. But if you do have overgrowths of objectionable organisms in your gut, the best way to help yourself is to eat what I call food-grade mold. Camembert cheese, blue cheese, brie, sauerkraut. Wine, beer, miso. Fermented things really help the gut a lot.
I do sauerkraut, and I love miso, too. I had miso
wonderful.
For dinner.
And, of course, good quality yogurt about a quart a week.
I'm allergic to that, and if I eat yogurt, I get a stomach ache.
No one is allergic to yogurt. There's nothing in yogurt that anyone could be allergic to. But I suggest to get over your mental block to it, because it's merely mental, not physical, is to start with a teaspoonful and have a teaspoonful a day until you feel safe and confident with that, and then bump up to a tablespoonful a day. Make sure that you get only plain yogurt. My favorite is Dannon, but whatever yogurt you like, so long as there's nothing in it but yogurt.
Yeah, we've got
certainly no powdered milk.
In Vermont, we've got some local yogurt makers here.
But be sure that's no powdered milk, because certainly powdered milk could.
No. I've looked at the ingredients.
Make sure that it's just yogurt, teaspoon a day till you feel comfortable, then a tablespoon a day, right? And keep increasing the amount. Your ultimate goal is only a half a cup of yogurt a day. It's a tiny amount. If you want to put something in it, that's certainly fine, but buy it plain.
That sounds great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hope this
thank
helps,
you.
And feel free to call back in if you want to at any time. Green blessings.
Oh,
good
you.
Night.
Thank you.
All right. Are you ready to go back to some email questions?
Certainly.
All right. I've been dealing with the results of too much estrogen in my system, like uterine polyps and hemorrhagic cysts. I've been treating it with allopathic medicine and surgery, which was an emergency and was the right choice. But ever since then, my doctor has wanted to rely heavily on surgery and refuses to address or help the actual cause of symptoms, which is too much estrogen. He blames it on my weight, which is 20 pounds over. But guess what? I hike, I walk, I'm active, I watch what I eat. And now, because of this estrogen imbalance, I am anemic. I am drinking nettle infusions and red raspberry leaf infusions, but are there any other herbs I can use that would stimulate natural progesterone? I've been bleeding for over 3 months, and the doctor insinuated it's my own fault since I won't do an expensive exploratory surgery. I know it's time for a new doctor. I just like herbalism to complement allopathic medicine, and perhaps the wise woman on here might have some ideas.
Okay, let me say again, I am an allopath. All herbalists are allopath. The only medicine that we do is allopathic medicine. If you want something that's not allopathic, you need to look for a homeopath. I'm a little uncertain as to how old this woman is. Does she say, Rebecca?
She does not say how old she is.
Doesn't say how old she is, and that kind of leaves me a bit at a loss. But let's just cover some basics, and maybe that will be of some assistance. If we look at estrogen production over a 28-day cycle, we will see that as menstruation commences, estrogen is low. As a matter of fact, what generally causes menstruation is a fall in the level of both estrogen and progesterone, and those hormones returning to baseline levels. Throughout the first week of the menstrual cycle, of which 3 to 5 days are generally spent bleeding, both estrogen and progesterone remain at their lowest levels for the entire month. As we move into the second week of the menstrual cycle, estrogen begins to increase. Along with the increasing estrogen, there are a great many changes that go on in the body, and this culminates with the production of a very potent estrogen called estradiol or estradiol. and this is produced midpoint in the cycle. It's produced for a short period of time, usually 24 to 48 hours. And the production of estradiol causes a cascade of events. The ovulation of the follicle, the ripened follicle, which leaves behind its yellow body, the creation of luteinizing hormone, the processing and use of follicle-stimulating hormone, and the movement of the egg down and through the egg tube and toward the uterus. All these things occur when estrogen is at its highest point. As the egg moves toward the uterus, estrogen remains rather high. Progesterone is also at a high point as ovulation occurs. If the egg successfully implants, estrogen stays moderately high and progesterone begins to rise. The idea that progesterone counters estrogen is not really true. I understand where it comes from, and that is that estrogen, as we see, is a proliferative hormone. It causes proliferation of tissues. When estrogen is high, it causes the proliferation of the endometrium, and when estrogen drops, then we menstruate. If a woman is taking estrogen replacement during or after menopause, the proliferative effects of estrogen can cause her to get uterine cancer. And so progesterone is added to the estrogen because the progesterone in this instance counters the proliferative effects of the estrogen. What I'm establishing here, let me see if I can make it very, very, very simple for you, is that the amount of estrogen in a woman's body varies every single day of her menstrual period, and that high estrogen is proliferation and low estrogen is menstruation, both within the normal range of estrogen for a woman's body. Let me also say that if we look at estrogen production over a 24-hour period, it goes up, down, 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 because estrogen is produced in pulses. It's not just like there's this hormone there and it's a there. No, it's actually produced by the body, and it's produced in pulses, and we can actually see this. So I'm a little bit at a loss as to how to answer your question because as far as I'm concerned, the way you're looking at this is not in sync with what's really going on in your body. And, of course, the reason I want to know how old you are is because bleeding, 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 well, you know what? That's a symptom of menopause, and it's not an unusual symptom of menopause either. No amount or lack of estrogen can make you anemic. Hello, you're anemic because you are not getting iron, and the iron in nettle is absorbable, but not nearly absorbable as the iron from blood. Anemic women need to go out and eat a steak or to go to their health food store and get some organic liver. Organic liver is one of the cheapest of all organic meats, and it brings up the amount of iron in the blood dramatically and very, very quickly, much more quickly than nettle can do because, after all, what's in that blood is what's in our blood, so it's almost like a transfusion, we might say, from the gifts of the animals to us. I'm happy that you're drinking your nourishing herbal infusions. Be sure you have a scale and that you weigh out a full ounce of nettle to put in your quart jar. It's not a handful or a volume amount. It really is a weight amount, and you do need to have a scale in order to do it. If you are in menopause, and I strongly believe from what you're saying that you are, although, it, again, without an age reference, it's hard to tell. If you're over 35, I would say you're in menopause. Then you might want to check out my book, New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way. There I have three options for women who are bleeding heavily. Again, this is one of the commonest symptoms of menopause, at least as common as hot flashes. And for some women, it's a bleed that goes on and on and on. And for other women, it's a big bleed that just dumps, as one woman put it, the meter-wide pool of blood on the pavement under my feet. So those three options are lady's mantle. Lady's mantle is used a lot in Europe, and it is considered a tonic to the uterus, and it's used for women who have a tendency to heavy menstrual bleeding. But because it is a tonic, it is usually used well before the fact, and you are into the bleeding now. So I don't think lady's mantle is really going to be the right one for you. Witch hazel is another wonderful blood-stopping herb, and it acts much more promptly than lady's mantle does. Witch hazel is a direct hemostatic. In other words, it causes blood vessels to constrict and contract and to stop bleeding. And witch hazel also has a direct and powerful effect on the uterus. However, I will tell you that of these three, my favorite is shepherd's purse. Witch hazel would be used as a tincture, not what you buy at the drugstore. And the shepherd's purse would be used as a tincture, too. Perhaps I'm partial to shepherd's purse because of my experience at birth and my friends, including my sister, who are midwives, and their love for shepherd's purse. They wouldn't go to a birth without it. I have seen shepherd's purse turn off heavy bleeding almost instantly, and I literally mean within a few seconds. But let me tell you my personal story. As I was going through menopause, I hit that bleed, that long and lengthy bleed. And it got to the point where I was feeling pretty weak and pretty anemic as I was bleeding. And as I was moving into my second month of bleeding, I found myself standing up, giving a talk to people for 3 hours and just barely being able to remain upright for that entire 3 hours. And I said, okay, Susan, enough is enough. You wanted to see what would happen, and you've seen what has happened. You're still bleeding, and you're feeling weak. Let's go get some herbs to stop this bleeding. Well, I was lucky enough to be staying with an herbalist, and I asked if she had any lady's mantle, and she didn't. And I asked if she had any witch hazel, and she didn't. So wasn't I lucky? The one I really wanted the most, shepherd's purse, was the one she had. And we drew me a dosage bottle of the shepherd's purse, and I took a dropperful right then. I was aware of the fact that shepherd's purse can cause uterine contraction, and that might make the bleeding heavier at the outset, so I prepared myself by making sure that there was adequate protection. And sure enough, I did get quite the gush of blood. And I waited another 4 hours, and then I took another dropper full of shepherd's purse, and about this time I was ready to go to bed, and I laid several old towels down on the bed and the plastic underneath them so that I wouldn't make a mess there, and took another dropper full of shepherd's purse tincture before I went to sleep. Woke up with a fair amount of blood, took 1/3, and that turned out to be the final dose of shepherd's purse, and by that afternoon, my bleeding had stopped, never to come back. I hope you find new menopausal gears, the wise woman way, of assistance to you. If not, please check out down there, Sexual and Reproductive Health, where I also have a chapter on heavy bleeding, and you may find something that could be of use to you. But it is allopathic. Green blessings.
All right. Next question. I am writing to ask for a little help in a situation I am having. My friend is bipolar. She has been on medication for many years. Last November, when she went to California for a month, she went cold turkey and has not had any medication since. She's a bit hyper now, and her daughter and mother want her to go back on her meds, and she chooses not to at this time. We are trying to find some homeopathic measures, doctors, healers, etc., and therefore, that is why I need your help. Do you know of someone who could help or any kind of medical doctor that may not rely on major meds for this sickness?
I do know referrals. Never have, never will. Dicey thing to do. One of my dear herbal buddies was approached by someone who wanted to know what midwife had been used for a recent birth in their family. And my herbal buddy said, don't want to tell you. And this woman persisted, as a matter of fact, kind of badgered my herbal buddy by phone, by person, coming to the clinic, really just, you know, unrelentingly pushing for this midwife's name. Well, finally, as most people would, my herbal buddy relented, gave in, and said, okay, the midwife was so-and-so. This woman then went and said to the midwife, I really want you to attend my birth. And the midwife said, I'm in semi-retirement. I don't really want to do it. And once again, the woman badgered and just beat at her about doing the birth. And again, as many of us would, the midwife relented and said, all right, she would do it. It turned out that the woman was pregnant with twins. It was an extremely difficult birth, and one of the babies died. The woman's insurance company, not the woman, but the woman's insurance company, sued the midwife and sued my herbal buddy, whose supposed recommendation it was. And my herbal buddy was sued for $1 million. I don't do referrals.
Okay, are you ready for another question?
I am.
Okay.
And
hello,
P.S.
I read your article.
Wait, what's Rebecca?
That?
P.S.?
Mm-hmm.
P.S., I think she should take her meds.
Yeah.
P.S., she should take her meds.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We don't let people whose minds aren't working right make these kinds of decisions for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
We have all acknowledged by the fact that she has a diagnosis that her mind can go very, very fast and her mind can get very, very chaotic. And it's critically important with bipolar people to take their meds. Now, certainly, she can also drink nourishing herbal infusions. She might have to take less of those meds, but I do believe it is important for her to take those meds.
Okay.
Okay, next question.
All right. Hello, I read your article on cancer-curing properties found in mushrooms. My husband is still a skeptic when it comes to the same properties found in our own little button grocery store variety mushrooms. What do you say? Is there anything to rid my body of HPV? It often goes away, but not finding it happening for me, and want to know of something herbal I can try. I am 54 and in otherwise good health.
Okay, so if you would just remind me, there was something at the beginning before she asked about human papillomavirus?
Yes, she was asking about cancer-curing properties found in mushrooms and if the same properties are found in the grocery store variety mushrooms, and then she went into
the experiments done at Duke University in the 50s found that all mushrooms were able to kill cancer cells in petri dishes except for canned mushrooms. So to me, it's not a matter of opinion, it's a matter of scientific fact that all mushrooms have the ability to kill cancer cells. Now, does petri dish translate into the works the same in the human body? That we don't know. Have double-blind studies been done on all mushrooms? No. Have some mushrooms, which are renowned for their anti-cancer abilities, been tested? Yes. Does your husband have cancer? Or are we talking about eating mushrooms to stay healthy and to act as a cancer preventative? Is this just one of the ways that you two are close and intimate, by sparring with each other this way? If he doesn't have cancer, and it doesn't really matter, really, whether or not the button mushrooms do or don't deal with cancer, what matters is they help prevent cancer. So include more mushrooms in your diet. Okay.
And then the next question in there is, the human papillomavirus.
Papillomavirus. Okay. Down there sexual and reproductive health, The Wise Woman Way has an entire chapter on human papilloma virus and things that can be done about that. So that would be the thing that I would direct you to, since it's a pretty long chapter. But as we recall, there's those little help boxes, so let's get in here and see what it says. Help! HPV, right? Visible warts, you'll get results in 2 weeks. Cervical lesions, you'll get results in 2 to 3 months. Visible warts rarely give rise to cancer. There are, of course, a great number of human papilloma viruses. Medically, all warts are papilloma. There are more than 100 known papilloma viruses. Some are generalists and can cause warts anywhere, but most are quite specific and actually fussy about where they live. So the ones we can see, the visible warts, sometimes called genital warts, fresh celandine sap can be applied to those, which will cause them to turn brown and to shrink and eventually fall off. For cervical lesions, and rarely does someone know that they have surgical lesions because you have to have a speculum and a flashlight and vinegar and do a swab on your own cervix in order to see the cervical lesions. And the cervical lesions are the ones that can lead to cancer. A dropper full of St. John's wort tincture 2 to 4 times a day, and astragalus. Drink astragalus infusion, cook with astragalus, and work with these things on a regular basis, and within 2 to 3 months, your cervical lesions should be gone. Green blessings.
Okay, next question. I have been told that the blood pressure in my legs is very low compared to the pressure in my arms. I tend to have leg cramps often. I am trying to eat healthy and try to walk as much as I can. I am on my feet a lot, cement floors, and thought that might contribute to it. Is there something that can help? I would appreciate any information. My blood pressure fluctuates. My blood sugar is irregular. Thank you.
Life fluctuates. Life is irregular. Please don't try to put yourself in a box. Your blood sugar should fluctuate. Hey, if your blood sugar didn't fluctuate, you couldn't digest your food. You couldn't get energy out of your food. Blood sugar has got to be different from time to time, and so does your blood pressure as well. Those are normal fluctuations. As a matter of fact, now that we have computers that can measure blood pressure and pulse rate, it's quite fascinating to see how rapidly these change. And it was very interesting to me. They found that when they looked at pulse, that in a person who was very healthy, the pulse varied greatly, but it was within parameters. But that was a fairly large swing in those parameters, and that was indicative of greater health, as people were less and less healthy and more prone to heart disease and heart attack. The pulse rate continued to vary, but it varied over a narrow and narrow parameter. So the more fixed we are, the more narrow our parameters of change, the less healthy we are. I would say not to worry particularly. What I worry about is when people say, I'm trying to eat a healthy diet. Goodness only knows what you think is a healthy diet. So let me lay out a few parameters. Drink nourishing herbal infusions. To me, that's definitely the gold standard of a healthy diet, is drink your nourishing herbal infusions. I was just talking to my dear friend who's had multiple sclerosis for 25 years. She is wheelchair-bound, and it's difficult for her to cook. I wish that I could somehow engineer a stove that would be at her level. And she has to reach up, you know, way up above her to cook, and she's a horrible burn on her thigh right now because she spilled some boiling water on her. So it's a little hard for her to really adequately nourish herself. Yes, she gets meals on wheels and food from the food bank, but, again, it arrives cold. She would like it hot, you know? Not easy for her. She's been drinking nourishing herbal infusions, because I bring her already prepared Nourishing Herbal Infusions, and she says to me, she says, these have so improved everything about my life. She says, now if I really can't cook, I drink a glass of Nourishing Herbal Infusion. I drink it for breakfast. Sometimes I drink it for dinner. She says, and I know that I have all the nutrition I need right there in my Nourishing Herbal Infusion. So, as I said, that's the gold standard. That is, to me, the sine qua non of a good diet, is that we are drinking our Nourishing Herbal Infusions. After that, the diet, like our blood pressure, like our blood sugar, like our lives, should be varied. There should not be just one thing in the diet, but a variety of things. And those things should be actual real foods. Basically, what we want to avoid are things with ingredients. The fewer the ingredients in the food that we are eating, the healthier that food is. I hope this helps you, Green Blessings.
Okay, next question. Could you talk about cronewort when she is in flower, please? I made a vinegar with the flowering tops of cronewort. Are the leaves okay to harvest for salad when cronewort is flowering? Thank you very much.
Cronewort is Artemisia vulgaris. For those of you who don't know Artemisia vulgaris by the name cronewort, you will find that many books refer to it as mugwort. When I went out to spend some time and said, "Hi, mugwort, how are you doing?" she got furious at me and stomped her foot and said, "Don't call me mugwort. I have nothing to do with the drunken fantasies of people who have their noses in mugs. Can't you see my silver hair on every leaf? I give you the wise visions of old women. I am the crone. Call me cronewort, and that way you also won't mistake me for that upstart motherwort." Many people do find motherwort and mugwort to sound very much alike. So cronewort rather than mugwort. Cronewort, Artemisia vulgaris. Artemis, the goddess of the moon, the goddess of the birthing woman, the goddess of the herbalist, the goddess of the hunt. Diana, moon goddess, she who runs through the forest, certainly. Very, very important goddess in my life. Artemis. Artemis and the Artemisias is a genus of plants in the Asteraceae family, formerly the Compositae, and they include such notable plants as wormwood, tarragon, and southernwood, as well as sagebrush. Artemisia vulgaris is the source material for moxibustion. When that plant is being burned for the moxibustion, what is being burned is Artemisia chinensis, which is a kind of cronewort or mugwort, very related to the common weed that we have here. And yes, our weed can be used in exactly the same way. As the cronewort emerges from the ground early in the spring, the tender leaves are wonderful in salads, finely chopped. I also love to make vinegar of those young tender leaves. And that's partly because I'm pulling it out of the garden at that point with its roots and all. Of course, it's more like a rhizome than a root. So I pull it right up out of the garden, rinse it off, chop it up, put it in a jar, and pour vinegar over it and make a delicious cronewort vinegar from those tender spring croneworts. As the plant grows, and it grows rapidly, it can get shoulder high, head high, even higher than that. And the leaves become tougher and tougher. The amount of oils in the plant increase and increase. I generally don't enjoy vinegars made from cronewort once it starts to flower, nor would I put the leaves in my salad. Perhaps your taste buds are different than mine. Perhaps your textural perceptions are different than mine. But for me, those leaves are too tough and too bitter to be part of my salad. Green blessings.
All right, next question. Besides yogurt, on days that I'm not drinking nettle or oat straw infusion, what other foods can I eat that are rich in calcium? I want to have more than the daily requirements to help lengthen and strengthen my bones. I'm 29, and I have been drinking the infusions for a year and a half, and I have gained over 1.5 inches in height, and I do strongly feel this is due to the gifts of the infusions. I would like to continue getting taller, and I'm wondering about other foods that could help with this. Yoga once a week is also helping. Thank you very much. The infusions have helped me and are continuing to help me so much. I have much love and affection for you.
All right, let's think for a moment about calcium. Well, calcium carbonate is chalk. So calcium, although certainly it's a component of bones, is not what makes bones strong. Calcium, in fact, makes bones brittle. And that's why we find that the women with the highest intakes of calcium are the women most likely to break a bone. I may have mentioned before that there's a very interesting study going on in the United States called the Nurses' Home Health Study. And they're not doing anything to these nurses at all. They're just asking them to fill out a questionnaire several times a year. And then we kind of delve into the pool of data that we collect and see what we can find. Well, fairly recently, within the past 5 years, we jumped into that pool of data and looked at broken bones and calcium consumption. And what we found was that any nurse who was consuming 1,500 milligrams of calcium or more on a daily basis was twice as likely to break a bone as any nurse who was getting a mere 800 milligrams of calcium. Now, part of this, they seem to think, had to do with the supplementation. And it's very difficult to get 1,500 milligrams simply from food alone, so that most women who want that much calcium in their diet do supplement in some way, whether they drink fortified orange juice or whether they actually take a pill of some kind. And so the finger was kind of pointed at the supplements. The finger then, you know, kind of pressed hard on calcium. And some evidence turned up showing that high levels of calcium in a woman's body do predisposition her toward kidney stones. But worse yet, high levels of calcium in a woman's blood seem to lead toward heart attack. So I don't think you really want more calcium. I hear that you have grown an inch and a half. I don't know what you believe, but I'll tell you what I believe. What I believe is that the yoga did it and not the nourishing herbal infusion. So far as I know, it is indeed a physical impossibility for bone to lengthen at the age that you are. Certain changes have occurred within your bone, and if those changes haven't occurred, you would be in a very bad pickle. So yoga, however, can open up and free up the spine and the joints, literally resulting in people who measure taller. I'm so glad you're doing yoga, and I'm so glad you're drinking the nourishing herbal infusions, and I'm so glad you're eating yogurt. And don't worry about the calcium. In fact, bones are not just made of calcium. They're made of lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of different minerals. So long as you're drinking your nourishing herbal infusions, eating your yogurt, and eating your well-cooked vegetables, you're going to get all of those minerals that you need for good, strong, healthy bones. Keep up the good work. Green blessings.
Okay, looks like we have about 10 more minutes left before your interview. So,
yes. We'll be talking tonight with Amy Ryan, and she practices law specializing in the commercialization of new medical technologies, but she's not going to be talking about that. She's going to be talking about her book, Staying Alive with Diabetes. So hang in there. We'll answer a few more questions, and then we'll be hearing from Amy Ryan.
Okay. I am writing for help with my hormonal acne. I get very painful spots and cysts on my chin for the last 3 years, and it worsens just before ovulation and menstruation. The spots alternate sides of my chin every week or so. I've had my hormones tested at day 22 of my cycle and know that I am what's called estrogen dominant. with very low progesterone, low estrogen, and high ratio of estrogen to progesterone. I take Vitex tincture during the second half of my cycle and peony tincture daily. I take burdock tincture 3 times a day. I drink nourishing herbal infusions, mostly red clover, 1 quart a day. I eat tons of yogurt and do eat animal fat. I feel like I have tried every skincare treatment, topical or internal, and every elimination diet in the book, but nothing has made the chin spots disappear. I am 25 and have dealt with this for 3.5 years. It began to directly after a deeply traumatic event when I was 21. Please help.
So let's remember a few of the things that we've talked about tonight, and that is that hormones fluctuate, and they should be fluctuating. And I don't really think that you are estrogen dominant, except that you're a woman, and that woman is estrogen dominant. But I don't go along with this diagnosis at all here. Nor do I necessarily think that has anything to do with what's going on with your chin spots. You yourself just said that these chin spots started after a traumatic incident. So trying to blame your body for this is not really fair now, is it? Let's think about trauma. Trauma occurs when one solid thing smacks into another solid thing. Like I was out rafting with a group of women at the upper reaches of the Hudson River. It was a trip I'd been on several times, and as we came around the bend in the river, I remembered that this was a place where I had to paddle really hard, so I started paddling really hard, but the river fooled me. It had thrown a sandbank right in my way, and there I was paddling hard, dug my paddle into the sand, flipped myself out of the boat. Oh, my goodness, really wrenched my arm. That's what I mean by trauma. One hard thing impacted another hard thing, and that is true at a certain level. But at another level, there's no hard thing at all in the world, no hard thing at all in the universe, because all hard things are made of atoms, and atoms, let's face it, are mostly space. Yes, indeed, there's a nucleus with all those electrons whirling around and around and around, and if you put the nucleus at the center of a football stadium, right in the midline, the electron cloud would be all the way out to the furthest last row of seats, high, high, high up in the stadium. There's that much space in everything. All the things that we think of as solid are really space, spacious. How many spiritual teachings of the world tell us that we are spacious, that we are indeed filled with There's a Zen koan, and it says, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Now, when we are thinking about this, what we are supposed to understand is that what makes the sound of clapping is resistance. So if there is one hand, and that one hand passes through the air and never comes against another solid thing, then there can be no clap. Trauma occurs when two solid things smack into each other. Yet there are no really solid things, for everything is made of atoms, which are spacious. We can only have trauma if there are two hands clapping. We are always in control of one hand. What are you resisting? What resistance came up for you at this time? Go back to that time and create spaciousness. I slept by the river that night, and every time I woke in pain, I thought space. I imagined my paddle sinking through the sandbar, sinking down, down into the earth. I removed resistance. I removed my half of the solidity. And by the morning, my injury was practically gone. Love yourself. Be kind to yourself. Find the space so that we can eliminate your need for trauma. Green blessings.
Would you like to try to answer one more question here?
I think we have time for one more.
Yeah, we have about 4.5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Hi, Susan. I've been drinking 3 quarts of nettle infusion per week for 2 weeks and am feeling no different.
Rebecca, I want to let me stop you for a minute.
Okay.
I don't know if it was the last one or the one before that who said that I'm drinking nourishing herbal infusions, mostly red clover.
Yes.
No. No, 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 no. Not if you're really making infusion. 2, at the most, 3 quarts of red clover a week. Red clover is a blood thinner. It's not safe to drink red clover infusion on a daily basis. Please do not do that. Did you find which one that was?
It was the last question about the...
It was the question. Okay, good. Sorry, it was a little slow in the uptake there, but I had made a mental note. Let's see if we can get our 4 minutes on this last question here. Go ahead.
Okay. I've been drinking 3 quarts of nettle infusion per week for 2 weeks and feeling no different. How long before I notice something? I am using 1 ounce per quart jar and leaving it to soak overnight. I'm using Frontier Herbs. I'm looking forward to using oat straw as well. Thanks for any feedback.
What did you want to notice? I'll tell you what most people notice. Most people notice that their skin tone improves. Most people notice that they have less indigestion. Most people notice that their hair looks better. Most people notice that their energy is better. Most people notice they have a sparkle in their eye. Most apprentices who come and live with me and drink a quart of infusion daily for 10 days notice these changes within those 10 days. Since you're piddling around at 3 quarts a week, it may take as much as a month or 6 weeks. Green blessings. Step it up. Drink more.
Sounds good. All right. It does look like Amy is here. Would you like me to bring
her
on?
Sure, let's go right ahead.
Okay.
Do we have Amy?
We do. Hello, it's Amy Ryan.
Oh, wonderful. Welcome to another women's radio show with Susan Weed. I am bringing you voices of people, but especially women, who are making change. Sometimes they make small changes, and sometimes they make large changes, but all changes are useful in this time of change. Amy Ryan lives in Alexandria, Virginia, with her family. She's a graduate of the University of Virginia and the Georgetown University Law Center. She practices law in Washington, D.C., specializing in the commercialization of new medical technologies. I have a dear cousin who lives nearby you and practices in D.C., too.
Oh, do you?
Amy has had type 1 diabetes for nearly 20 years. Is that about half your life, Amy?
Well, it's a little less than half my life. I just turned 47, so I had to do the math.
She wrote SHOT, S-H-O-T, Staying Alive with Diabetes, to create a readable account of this very difficult disease, one that would be different from the numerous how-to books about diabetes. She wanted a book that could be shared with family, friends, and others to raise awareness about what life is really like for those with type 1 diabetes. You know, I have a dear friend who has type 1 diabetes, and I will say that it took me, the better part of a year to realize that she was testing her blood sugar under the table and injecting herself through her clothes when she needed to. The woman did it, you know, just so much as part of her life and so matter-of-factly that it really took a great awareness for me to even notice that this was going on. So, you know, I find that many people somehow think that diabetes is like kind of a punishment and that you get diabetes because you don't eat well or because there's something, you know, like you're overweight or so on. But I know that that isn't true about type 1 diabetes. although it could be true about type 2 diabetes. So we've got a lot that we need to discuss here. Should we start by making a distinction? Could you make a distinction for us between type 1 diabetes, which you have, and type 2 diabetes, which is also called adult onset diabetes?
Yes, absolutely. I would love to. And what you just said is absolutely accurate in my experience, in that people often do think it's a punishment for a life, you know, not well lived or not taking good enough care of yourself. And type 1 diabetes, the causes of type 1 diabetes couldn't be further from the truth. Type 1 diabetes is actually an autoimmune disease that is brought on strictly by a malfunction of the body's own autoimmune system. And when that happens, the autoimmune system destroys the individual's beta cells, which are the cells in the pancreas that produce insulin. And when the pancreas is under attack, it stops making insulin permanently. It never recovers. And as a result, people who have type 1 diabetes have to take multiple injections of insulin every day to stay alive. It's the type that used to be known as juvenile diabetes, though that's a little bit of a misnomer because it's not always, quote-unquote, juveniles that it strikes. It strikes about as many people in their 20s, which is the time when I got it, as it does children. So it's really a disease that for the most part strikes before age 30. Type 2 diabetes, by contrast, is no less serious. It has the same long-term complications. It has the same risks, but it has entirely different causes. It's not an autoimmune disease. It is sometimes brought on by, you know, poor diet and sedentary lifestyles, but it also has a genetic component. You know, I agree with type 2 that people are often unfairly judged about what might have brought on their illness. And the other point that I'll make about the distinction is that type 2 diabetes is the one we most often see in the headlines that's currently referred to as an epidemic. I think about 20 million Americans have type 2 diabetes, as opposed to type 1, the type that I have, which about 3 million Americans have.
There does seem, however, to be a growing incidence of type 1 diabetes among very young children.
I have read that as well, and I can't opine on the cause of that, and having gotten diabetes in my 20s and thankfully not having a child who has diabetes, I'm not as familiar with that, but I've heard the very same thing, that it is being diagnosed with increased frequency in young children.
Yeah.
And there may be some environmental factors is one theory, but I'm not sure of all the theories that are out there.
Yeah. And we do know that it is an autoimmune disease, that the pancreas is literally attacked and destroyed by the immune system. And it's, you know, I have seen, since my first involvement in healing, people with type 1 diabetes saying, is there something I can do with my diet? Is there something I can do to get off insulin? And I look at them and I say, no, be thankful there's insulin.
Exactly.
I mean, my grandfather was a type 1 diabetic and there wasn't insulin.
Is that right? Because insulin was created in the 20s. But even, I don't know when your grandfather lived, but even then, I mean, there have been so many advances in insulin technology that long ago, it was a really, really dicey game to be on insulin.
It was indeed. But now, I mean, it is just wonderful. There's a lot of diabetes in my family, so it's always been something that's been quite interesting to me because, of course, I want to beat the rap.
Right.
Well,
odds are you've beaten type 1, right? But you can, and you live a healthy lifestyle, so maybe you'll be in luck without type 2 as well.
Indeed. They kept a close eye on me while I was pregnant. And I really, my numbers got real bad toward the end of the pregnancy, but not bad enough that they, you know, wanted to pull any plugs on me, thank goodness.
Right, right.
What made you think you might have diabetes before the diagnosis?
Well, before the diagnosis, I had no idea that I had symptoms of diabetes. I had a yeast infection, which I'd never had before, which I now know, but I didn't know then, is a sign of diabetes. And I've learned that actually since my book has been out. Many women have written to me and said that that's how they learned that they had diabetes, was from recurring yeast infections. So in my case, I had a yeast infection, my first ever. I treated it. As soon as I stopped treating it, it came back, treated it again, it came back again. So on the second or third time, my GYN, which is the doctor I was seeing for my yeast infection, said, you know, maybe we should check your glucose level because, maybe, you know, frequent yeast infections can be a sign of diabetes. And I just thought, I mean, even hearing the word diabetes didn't really mean anything to me. This was almost 20 years ago, and, it, you know, it wasn't as much in the news, and I had heard of it, but I had absolutely no idea what it meant or the different types that were out there. But just right there in the GYN's office, she gave me a glucose test, you know, just a finger stick, and my blood sugar was well over 300, and she said, oh, you have diabetes. So there wasn't a buildup.
It was just like that, right? Let's go back just a tiny bit to something that you and I understand, but that our listeners might not understand.
Sure.
Basically, what we're talking about when we're saying that you had a high blood sugar is that literally there is a lot of sugar in your blood.
Correct.
And that sugar is not supposed to be in your blood except, you know, narrow parameters. And when there's that much sugar in your blood, then organisms in the vagina use that as food. And that's why that reoccurrent yeast infection can be a signal for diabetes, because that there's sugar in the urine. The old-fashioned test for diabetes was you had someone pee on the ground and you watched to see if the ants came to it.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And it's the sugar and the urine that feeds the yeast infection as well. And, you know, I didn't know that at all, but, you know, once I know, you see a warning now if you buy an over-the-counter treatment that says, you know, you should be aware that frequent yeast infections could be a sign of diabetes, and it's obviously true for type 1 or type 2.
Yes. Yeah. So there you were in the doctor's office, and suddenly you were being told you were diabetic.
Right, and suddenly I had this number, 323, which I had no idea what it meant, which caused the nurse in my next doctor's office to literally shriek when she heard it. And that was a really jarring way to get introduced into this new world of glucose tests and ultimately insulin, which came a few days later.
Wow. What do you say about that in your book, Shot?
Well, I mean, I try to bring the reader with me and join me in terms of how utterly shocking and confusing and scary and disorienting this all was, to kind of, you know, go home alone. I was living alone at the time. I was in my late 20s. Go home alone with this new machine that I'm being told I need to check my blood sugar level, which is far too high, with a stack of pamphlets. At the time, there was no internet or WebMD, so I didn't have a great deal of information, and just be sent home basically to read and find out what diabetes is about and come back to the doctor a few days later and see how I'm doing. And I didn't know what any of that meant, or what I was supposed to do in the interim, or what I was supposed to do when I repeatedly got these glucose levels that were off any chart in any of the pamphlets that they give you. You know, these medical pamphlets will have a friendly little drawing that looked a little bit like a speedometer with a green zone when these are good glucose levels, a yellow zone when these are potentially dangerous, start monitoring your glucose levels, and then a red zone, which they made sound like emergency, coma, who knows what, and I was way past the red zone, and there I was home alone. So it was a really terrifying and disorienting time, and I tried to portray that aspect of it a lot in the start of the book when I'm just getting used to the diagnosis and before I've figured my new life out.
So what did you figure out? I mean, you, like, you have a professional life. How does this work?
Right. Well, I mean, then I had a professional life then. That was before, it was a few months before I was going to start law school. I was working then. I was working as a paralegal. And I mean, that's one of the hard parts of the diagnosis, which I'm sure is true for many other diagnoses, not just diabetes. But the world kind of doesn't stop and wait for you to get control of yourself and figure it out and move on. Everything keeps happening, and it's just, or it was for me anyway, just a big emotional and coping adjustment to get to the point where I didn't feel like this was going to run my life. And that was a long process. It was months. It was a long and painful process. Particularly, you know, getting used to using insulin, which is a really tough thing to use. You know, we have lots of better and more effective and more predictable types of insulin even now than we did nearly 20 years ago when I was diagnosed. But it's still difficult being on insulin. You don't take an injection and then just go about your activities. You have to monitor yourself so closely, really every couple of hours, and adjusting to that on a long-term basis and realizing that's not going to change, for me anyway, took a really, really, really long time. But I got there.
The dedication to oneself that is required is very unique in a way. I mean, I can say, oh, well, my goal is to walk 3 miles every day. But the truth of the matter is, if I don't, nothing bad happens to me.
Right, right.
But
right.
You have to take care of yourself, or really bad things happen to you.
Right, and they happen quickly. Like, you can't, I mean, you can let things slip to a degree, and people do that, and I certainly do that. And, you know, there's a phenomenon that's known as diabetes burnout that a lot of people with type 1 diabetes suffer from, and I certainly have gone through that. And, you know, actually the title of my book, to me, speaks to burnout, because in my mind, the title shot was always an adjective. It meant tired. It meant worn out, exhausted. And it's been interesting because a lot of people, when they see the title, say, oh, why didn't you name it shots, plural, because it's all about the shots. And I explain that. Well, it's kind of about the shots, but the people who have type 1 diabetes and who have read the book, they get the title right away. They say, yeah, we are shots. We are so tired of this. But the fact that you say that is true because, you know, there are still degrees of care. You can't stop taking insulin altogether or bad things will happen very, very quickly, I mean, within a day. But you can lighten up on your control in a way that will be dangerous in the long run in terms of long-term complications, but will give you a little relief in your day-to-day worry level. So that's the thing, you know, another thing that's just challenging about keeping up with this disease is you really have to be honest with yourself about whether you're doing a good job or not taking care of it, because you can fudge for a while without anything really bad happening. It's only later that you'll feel the effects of that.
We had a diabetic friend that we thought was having a heart attack.
And was it low blood sugar or was it her heart?
It actually was a heart attack.
Oh.
Yeah. But, you know, we said, oh, she's having a heart attack. And this is, oh, no, she's a diabetic. It's low blood sugar. Da, da, da. But she was actually having a heart attack.
Wow.
Takes such care of herself. And, you know, she's a dear woman, but she just is shot. She's shot. She just doesn't take care
right.
of herself at all.
Mm.
You know, and so we were, like, really kind of caught ups, you know.
Right.
So fortunately, we were able to get her to a hospital in time.
Oh, gosh, that's scary.
But diabetes is scary.
It is scary.
That's
scary.
Part of the burnout. That's part of the shot. It's like you're living with this constant fear.
Mm-hmm. And it's a constant. It's not even if it's not a constant fear, it's a constant or near constant level of awareness of all of these things that are in the back of your mind. What was your glucose level when you woke up? How much insulin did you take? What are you doing for the next 2 or 3 hours? You know, what are you going to eat for lunch? Are you going to exercise? Are you going to walk to the metro or take a taxi? Like, all of those things figure into the equation. So even if it's not, you know, fear of having a low blood sugar episode, the tiring part of it is that there's some part of your mind that's kind of always aware of that or thinking about that. So psychologically, it's a really challenging and tiring disease.
Yes, exactly. And that's how I, you know, kept myself, you know, back in the yellow zone and not in the red zone on gestational diabetes was I upped my exercise level.
That helps a lot. That does help a lot. And it helps a lot.
It really does.
I've heard that helps a lot with gestational and also with type 2. And even, I mean, it helps with me. If I take a good brisk walk for 20 minutes or 40 minutes, that helps too.
It does. One of the artists who has worked for my publishing company was diagnosed at a very young age,
mm-hmm.
I think before the age of 3, with type 1 diabetes.
Oh, boy.
Of course, his parents took care of him until he became old enough to take care of himself. And once he became old enough to start taking care of himself, he started reading avidly. And, of course, they had told the parents that he would maybe graduate high school.
Right, I know. I mean, that's what kids used to hear. They don't hear it anymore, thank goodness.
There have been so many
advances, but that's what they used to hear.
And that they should never, you know, they shouldn't put aside a college fund or think of him getting married. That probably, well, he wasn't going to live long enough for that, damn it. Anyhow, by the age of 10, he had become such an expert on diabetes, and he decided that he was going to become an expert on exercise.
Oh.
He's now married, has 2 children. He's in his late 30s.
Uh-huh.
And he exercises 4 hours a day.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So I have seen in a variety of diabetes situations exercise really play an important role. But again, if this circles back to what you're saying and what I think you're saying in the book, is it requires self-care. He can't say, I'm going to skip my workout today.
Absolutely not.
No bad days allowed for the diabetic.
Right. Well, and that's the other thing, and I have one tiny little bit about this in my book because it's another adjustment to get to. It's the same point you're making, is that nobody else can take care of this for you. I remember very early in the process, the guy who was then my boyfriend, who's now my husband, went with me to one of my first appointments at the endocrinologist, which is who you see when you have diabetes, and they were talking about me as if I wasn't there, like she needs to do this and she needs to do that, and normally that would have annoyed me to no end, and I wouldn't have let that go on, but in that moment, I enjoyed it because I thought, oh, let them talk about this. Maybe they can figure out how to take care of me, because it hadn't sunk in at that very, very early phase that no one ever was going to be able to take care of this but me. And that's a hard realization to make, too.
That's a very powerful level of personal responsibility, isn't it?
It is. And then you get used to it. But, you know, Go ahead. Well, I was going to say the other thing that people used to be told, as you were talking about your friend who was told, you know, that his parents shouldn't have a college fund or anything for him. You know, women used to be told to have a hysterectomy and don't bother thinking about trying to have a baby because that will be too dangerous. And that certainly is not the case anymore. It was not the case when I was diagnosed 18 years ago, but people did plant a lot of seeds in my mind at that time about, you know, how difficult it could be to have a baby. And, you know, so that was another hard part of getting the diagnosis in my 20s.
But you are a mom.
I am a mom. I'm a stepmom and a mom.
Did you have gestational diabetes, or does that not count?
Well, it doesn't count. I had type 1 diabetes, so it stayed. I had type 1 diabetes when I was pregnant, and so that's the good thing. I can't get gestational diabetes because I already have type 1. And so, but I was really fortunate to have great insurance coverage, great medical care. I had a perinatologist who I actually spoke with his office 2 or 3 times every week to report my glucose levels and to have my insulin dosages adjusted. So it was a very intensive management process, but, having a baby inside to take care of, there's no better motivation than that.
Indeed. So to go back, gentle listeners, to what we're talking about, and this is Susan Weed talking with Amy Ryan about her book, Shot, Sugar in Your Blood. We're talking diabetes. She had a test. Said, oh, you have sugar in your blood. This is what defines diabetes, is sugar in your blood. Now think about it. If there's sugar in your blood, and we talked about how this can give rise to yeast infections in the vagina, what happens to the baby? And this baby, if we're not really careful, it's going to get fed a very sugary diet. And this baby can get way too big, way too fast.
That's right. And the baby also doesn't have its own pancreas, which produces insulin, for a long time. I forget when in the gestational process the baby gets a pancreas, but for much of the baby's early life in utero, she's getting purely her mother's glucose level with no additional insulin to offset it. So, and particularly in the developmental stages when the limbs are being formed and the brain and the spinal cord are being formed, those very high glucose levels can be damaging to the formation of those kind of vital limbs and organs. And then it also
which is why you were all keeping such a severe and close check?
Yes.
Your glucose levels, because it's not just you.
Right. Managing type 1 diabetes when you're pregnant, I don't want to ever suggest that it's easy, but it's easier in some ways because of advancements in insulin pumps and also in the use of continuous glucose monitors, which are monitors that you can wear on your body that leave a sensor inserted under your skin that give you a near constant glucose level reading. I don't know how they update every 90 seconds or something like that. So you can tell if for some reason that you wouldn't have predicted your glucose is unexpectedly rising or unexpectedly falling. And that helps to kind of balance out the highs and the lows in a way that we didn't have before.
Yes, because again, the testing is going on continuously. And
right.
I'm sure that there are listeners going, Cringe, excuse me, something is inserted under your skin. But gentle listeners, after you have stuck your fingers numerous times, day after day, week after week, month after month, a little something that is inserted under your skin seems really benign.
Well, you do get used to it. I don't wear a continuous glucose monitor, but I do wear an insulin pump now, which leaves a little tube constantly inserted under my skin delivering insulin. And so I still have to prick my finger to do a glucose test, which I do about 10 to 12 times a day. Now that I wear the insulin pump, as long as the pump is functioning properly, I don't have to give myself injections of insulin because I get it all through this tube under my skin. But before I was on the pump, I was doing 5 or 6 injections of insulin a day, and that gets to be a lot to manage. So you do, as you were saying, Susan, you get used to being stuck. It's not that big a deal after like 20,000 of them, but it would still be nice not to do.
And it hurts.
It does.
Okay, it's a big deal, but it hurts later. is my experience,
right.
is it doesn't hurt so much with the finger bunch, but then like an hour or so later, it's like annoying.
Yeah.
Right there.
It
but
does
again,
to be that
you,
way.
You kind of, yeah, you kind of get, you, human beings are so adaptable. We can deal with just about anything that
right,
life
right.
does. Now, we are coming close to the end of the show, so let's be sure that people know where they can find SHOT if they're interested in getting a copy of the book. What would be the best place for them to look for SHOT?
The best place to look for SHOT is on Amazon and on barnesandnoble.com. It's also available on the JDRF's book site. The JDRF is the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, which is the biggest funder of research into type 1 diabetes. So they have it in their bookstore, and it's also available on my publisher's website, which is Hudson Whitman Excelsior College Press.
That's a long name.
It is a long name. So maybe Amazon
that's a very long name. Amazon sounds like a fairly good, simple name, and most people know
it. I think everyone
can
remember that.
I think they can. I always say, you know, the place that's named after a big, strong woman. So you're not going to be able to hear the prompts to Amy Ryan. Only I will be able to hear them. But we are on a timed call, and the call will, you know, just bump us off. So I'm going to give you this last bit of time, and I'm going to relay the prompts to you so you kind of know where you are.
Okay.
And my question to you is, what do you want to leave these people thinking about? What do you want to leave in their hearts? Here's your last couple of minutes to speak to them.
Well, I think I would just like to thank you, Susan, for having me, and thank the people who have listened. I hope that I've brought about a change with my book by helping people to better understand the differences between type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Anyone who's interested in the topic should feel free to reach out to me on my Facebook page. And I would just like to thank the many, many readers who have written me and who have had a very, very personal connection with the book and who, you know, have said that my story in some way changed their views about their disease or changed the way their families or friends or others understood their disease. And, you know, that's what I was just hoping to achieve with the book, and I'm so pleased to have heard that from so many people.
So Amy Ryan and her book, SHOT, Staying Alive with Diabetes. You can find her at Facebook, simple name, AmyRyan. Amy Ryan, a mom and a lawyer and a woman who's living with type 1 diabetes. You may not have any diabetes in your family. You may not have any friends with diabetes, but it's unlikely. And diabetes is a disease that comes around irrespective of your social class, irrespective of your racial grouping, irrespective of any choices that you've made in your life. You could still be diagnosed with diabetes just like Amy Ryan was. So you might want to pick up a copy of SHOT, Staying Alive with Diabetes, and find out how she dealt with it. And this is Susan Weed here at Women's Radio. Thank you so much for joining us to reweave the healing cloak of the ancients. Green blessings until we meet again.